Welcome to Novelist Spotlight, the podcast where published fiction writers are interviewed to gather their insights and writing lessons so we can use them to make ourselves better and more effective writers. There are just three things I ask of you, if appropriate to you and your experience. Please subscribe, please click on the like button, and please share this program link with any family members, friends, or colleagues who might be interested or benefit from the content. Now, on with our program. In the spotlight is Elliot Parker. He is the author of five novels. He writes thrillers where people, listen to the titles. Code for Murder, what does that tell you? A Knife's Edge, what does that tell you? There's multiple ways to die in an Elliot Parker book, so you want to be aware of that. He currently teaches English at the University of Mississippi, Ole Miss, as it's known, the Rebels, and think of the Manning family and all. I'm sure they've given a lot of money to the school. And he's also the recipient of the West Virginia Literary Merit Award. And one of his books, Fragile Brilliance, was a finalist for the Southern Book Prize in thriller writing. He recently received the Thriller Writer Award from the National Association of Book Editors for his novels. So he joins us now from you are in Mississippi. Is that right, Elliot? What city in Mississippi are you in right now?
Hey, Mike, I'm in Oxford, Mississippi. So,
and is that home to Ole Miss?
That is home to Ole Miss. Yes, I'm in the northernmost city in Mississippi. So I'm probably about, I would say, 50 to 55 miles south of Memphis, Tennessee.
Oh, wow. Music City. There is the argument between Memphis and Nashville about who's Music City, but I know that the people in Memphis say, hey, no, we're Music City. This is where Elvis started out. We were doing music before Nashville. We won't get into that argument, but nonetheless, the contest goes on. So Appalachian novels, what makes a novel Appalachian? Am I even pronouncing it right? How do you pronounce it?
Well, it depends really on where you're from. You know, I'm from West Virginia originally, and we pronounce it Appalachian.
Appalachian.
Yeah, but you know, it can be pronounced either way. Yeah, that's a great question. I think that, you know, an Appalachian novel has to have a few key components. I think that Appalachian novels typically are set in small towns or smaller towns as opposed to big cities. There's a familial component to the plot, meaning there's some element of family tied in, either the protagonist's family. If it's a thriller, the victim's family is involved. If it is, a small community where someone has been murdered that was prominent in the community, that concept of family could be everyone that he or she, being the victim, knew or interacted with. I think that's something that is important in terms of an Appalachian novel. I think Appalachian novels also feature elements of poverty, or this idea of wealth versus poverty, and how those two concepts juxtaposed against each other create conflict within the characters and the stories themselves. So I think, you know, in most of the Appalachian novels that I have read, and when I think about, you know, setting novels and stories in Appalachia, those are the kind of the three big ones that I try to incorporate. Because from those, Mike, you know, those three kind of themes or threads or motifs, you can do so much in your stories. You can do so much with character development, with plot, with red herrings, with conflict and secrets, and all of those things that make good stories can sort of spring out or branch off from those three concepts.
So is it very similar to Lowcountry? Is it, you know, Pat Conroy and other Southern writers who are in South Carolina and they from the Lowcountry. Is it very similar in that way? Or are there different elements to, say, a Lowcountry novel or novelist vis-a-vis Appalachian novelist? Do you know if there's a difference or not? I might be getting into an area that's like Lowcountry. I know what you're talking about, Mike, but I've never really studied.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I'm so glad you mentioned Pat Conroy. He is my favorite novelist. I read his book, The Prince of Tides, when I was in high school, and it's one of those books that just changed my life as a reader and as a writer.
It's beautiful. Well, it's a beautiful piece of writing. Oh, it's a beautiful story.
It is.
And Yeah, it's also depressing because it's kind of like, God, this guy, I could never write like this guy. Listen to the way he writes his music. And yeah, he was an amazing writer. He died too young, too. But so Lawyers, Guns, and Money, I was going to say thrillers, thriller writers. But now you have family, Appalachia. You mentioned family, but let's not forget guns, money, and lawyers. I'm sure there's lawyers as well that are part of the equation. Talk about when your characters will actually reach for the weapon or use that weapon. Talk a little bit about, you know, the type of characters you like to create and what makes them distinctive. I realize that's a broad question because you have a lot of different characters, but then you've got your primary characters. That's really what I'm thinking about, is the protagonist and your antagonist.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I think, you know, one of the things I try to strive for in creating my protagonists and my antagonists, and I've got kind of, in those books you mentioned in the intro, I've got two series kind of going on right now. I have the Fragile Brilliance Knife's Edge series, which features a police detective named Ronan McCullough, who is in Charleston West, who works for the Charleston Police Department, Charleston, West Virginia, where I grew up. And then I have another series, which is Code for Murder and a Final Call, which came out in November of 2021. And I have a female homicide detective named Stacy Tabbitt, who is operating out of Cleveland, Ohio, the Cleveland Police Department. So in creating both of those protagonists, especially, you know, I want them to seem real. I want them to seem like people you would know or people that you would identify with. And in terms of the weapons themselves, one of the things I try to do in my thrillers, guns are certainly a part of it, but I like explosions and I like fires and I like people being dumped in the water and I like those kinds of methods of conflict, physical violence, I guess, or physical conflict as opposed to guns, for a couple of reasons. Number one, I think those are much more interesting, and those create a whole nother subset of other problems. For example, in my Stacy Tabbitt series, one of the big things that Stacy deals with as a character is that in Code for Murder, the book begins with her on a undercover sting operation that goes badly, and she's knocked unconscious and dumped into the Ohio River, or excuse me, the Cuyahoga River, not the Ohio River, the Cuyahoga River. She suffers some lung damage as a result of that because she was unconscious and she had breathed in or, you know, taken in so much water before rescuers were able to pull her out of the water. And so she suffers from that. And I think that gives a dimension to her character that is so much better than had she been shot in that moment or had she, lost a finger as a result of a gun accident or something like that. Because that lung damage, it's not so debilitating that she can't function, but it's something that she has to live with and really affects the way that she investigates crime. And so for me, things like that are much more interesting than gunfights and shootouts, although there's a couple of those that pop up. But you just open up so many more possibilities with explosions and things like that, and bodies being dumped in the water or pushed off ledges and things like that. It just opens up so many other possibilities and so many more red herrings for the reader, because you have to think about, okay, if you push a character off the side of a cliff or off the top of a building, how did they get there? Who put them there? If this was a character that was of significant size and weight, well, was he or she able to push that person off by themselves? Did they have help? What if they hit the ground and survive? You know, what if they don't? So you just have all these other things that happen. You know, a shootout or a gunfight between characters is pretty final in the end. Someone's going to get shot and someone's not. So it's more open and shut, I think, than it is if you do other things. So that's typically what my protagonists get involved in, is explosions, fires, things.
High places, falling from high places,
falling into the water, having things tied to your feet and dropped in the water and that kind of thing. So I just think that opens
in some ways. Yeah. In some ways it's a little more convenient, because I've heard that law enforcement people say through television documentaries that the big issue people have when they kill somebody is they've got a body, and it's not easy to get rid of a body to dispose of it. Now, if they've already gone off a cliff, you won't go hiking, you push them off a cliff, then it's just, oh geez, the guy slipped and fell.
Right.
But when somebody literally kills somebody in somewhere, they especially if they do it on their own premises, then they've got the big issue of trying to get rid of a body, which apparently is not easy. and obviously traceable in a lot of different ways.
That's true.
So how did you, now you're teaching English at University of Mississippi, and so you're not teaching writing, you're teaching English, you're teaching mechanics, you're teaching the do's, the don'ts, the mortal sins, but not necessarily how to write, or do you teach literature?
I can teach a little bit of everything. The last 3 years, my primary emphasis has been on teaching scientific and technical writing. That's what my doctorate was in. My doctorate degree was in. I got my doctorate at Murray State. And so my emphasis there was scientific and technical writing, things like contracts, sales proposals, memos, emails, white papers, policy manuals, all those kinds of things, more business related documents. And so I've been teaching that quite a bit. I do teach intro to creative writing occasionally. And of course I can teach composition, but mainly I've been teaching a lot of business and technical writing, which is well, nice.
Let's go to, I mean, there's always business there. I mean, there's, you know, people, it's a skill people need, no question. And it applies. Let's go to the creative writing. Do you tell them in terms of creative writing? If a student says to you, well, what is creative writing really? What do you say?
Well, creative writing is very much about telling a story. And it doesn't really matter what genre of creative writing you're interested in, if it's poetry, screenwriting, fiction, nonfiction, memoir, whatever it may be. You know, your ultimate goal with a creative work is to tell a story. If you're a poet, maybe that's telling a story in 20 lines of writing that are five stanzas of four lines each. If you're a screenwriter, maybe that's 150 page screenplay that's got four acts and five parts to each act. If you're a novelist and teaching writing fiction or memoir, you know, maybe that's a 250 page story that you're telling. But creative writing comes down to storytelling. And, you know, that's one of the things we talk about on the first day of class is, you know, and really the first couple of weeks is what makes for a good story. You know, what makes for the kind of story that you would read over and over again from either a book, a play, a poem, whatever it is that you go back to. Same way that we watch certain movies over and over and over again, even though we've seen it 15 times, we know what's going to happen. It's kind of the same thing.
Yeah. What's the answer to that? What makes a good story or one that you want to come back to?
I think, you know, you have to have a couple of things, Mike. I think you've got to have a point of view that the reader can connect with. You know, I'm not a poet or a screenwriter, but there's all kinds of debates all the time in fiction writing. You know, what point of view am I going to use? Am I going to have a first person narrator where, you know, we're following one character through the story? Is this going to be third person limited where I can hop around from character to character and kind of get their side of the story or have them tell their part of the story? So they get to think about the point of view. I think you have to think about whoever your protagonist is going to be. What is their want or what is their need? What is it that they are trying to get or gain? And once you identify that, what is going to be the thing that keeps that person from getting or not getting whatever it is that they want? And certainly if we're talking about a thriller novel, you know, obviously there's been a crime committed and there's someone that has to investigate that crime. And obviously that's what the detective or, you know, whoever it is trying to solve. Well, what's going to get in the way of that detective being able to do that and why? So I think that's another element that you have to have. And then ultimately you have to think about what is going to keep this reader reading, even if it's a poem. What's going to get that reader from line one, stanza one, down to line 20, stanza five. And that's where your sensory details come in, you know, your taste, sight, touch, sound, hearing, feeling, all of that comes into play. You know, what is going to connect with the reader so that they'll finish whatever piece of creative work that you are doing and that you have started. So I think if you've got those four elements, at least to work with at the beginning, if you can identify that or specify kind of what your focus is in those areas, then you've got the skeleton in place for a story. And then it's just a matter of kind of filling in the outline or filling in the skeleton or putting flesh on the bones. And then seeing what you come up with. So it seems really complicated about, you know, what makes a good story. But if you ask most people what their favorite movie is, what their favorite TV show is, what their favorite, I mean, there's a reason people watch Law and Order episodes from 2002, from 20 years ago, even though the characters that are on the show then are not around now and they've seen the episode 25 times. It's because of the storytelling. It's because of the good storytelling. We have a point of view. We have a protagonist. We have an antagonist. We have a series of circumstances and a series of events that take place. And sometimes the detectives get closer. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes the attorneys on the second half hour get closer to the solving the problem or the crime. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes they win. Sometimes they get a conviction and they don't. So all of those things.
If you a lot of conflict.
A lot of conflict. Yeah, you've got to have conflict, and you've got to. So, you know, I tell my students this, Mike, to kind of wrap up that kind of this point is, you know, people will ask you all the time as a writer, even if you've never had anything published, which to me, you're a writer if you write. You don't have to have anything published to consider yourself a writer. But people will always ask you, how long did it take you to write that particular piece of whatever it is that you're doing? And people will say, oh, it took 2 hours, 3 hours, whatever. But nobody ever asks, or seldom asks, how much time did you spend thinking about that piece of writing before you wrote it? Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the things I emphasize with my students, too, is that writing is as much thinking about what you're going to do as it is actually sitting down and putting it together.
Yeah, good point. So I know you write in third person. I haven't looked at all of your books, but what about first person? Do you all sometimes write in first person? And what do you prefer?
I like third person limited. I like being able to, hop around, or sometimes called head hopping from character to character. I think you have to be careful with that sometimes, though, because if you hop around too many different characters' heads, you can distract the reader, and the reader can kind of forget, okay, where was this character when this happened, or what was this character's perspective when this event took place, or when this conversation happened. So I think it's called third person limited for a reason, in that if you're going to use kind of that head hopping, you need to be careful in terms of how many heads you hop into as the writer. I find first person, I'm not very good at writing first person. I've had some short stories published over the years that were in first person, but first person is very limiting because, you know, it's interesting in that the reader is seeing the action through the eyes and on the shoulder of one particular character. But the challenge for the writer is that character has to be, if it's a mystery or thriller, for example, that character has to be in every single chapter and every single scene of the story. You can't sort of shelve that character for a while off to the side in one chapter and bring in another character and get the point of view of what's going on from their perspective. That character has to be in every single scene and every single conversation and every single action that takes place in the story. So it's a great challenge to write first person for me. And I've heard a lot of other writers say the same thing, but it's very limiting as well. Mm-hmm. Unless you have a storyline or a plot where you know that the character that you're making in first person or writing in first person can be in every single chapter and every single scene. I think there's some writers that do that really well. Lisa Scottoline is a thriller writer that does wonderful work in first person, and she writes these wonderful thrillers, but she writes a lot of first person where her protagonist is in every scene and every chapter. But for me, it's tough to do. And I like the third person limited because I think it's interesting to get inside other characters' heads. And I think readers appreciate kind of getting to dip inside another character's point of view or perspective on certain things right. that are happening every so often.
It gives you that license to be omnipotent or omnipresent or both. And, so let's jump back to story for a minute. You know, the Irish are known for being natural storytellers, but so are Southerners here in the United States. I don't know if you agree with that or not, but that there is a reputation that people from the South are good storytellers. It's more natural to them than people in the rest of the country. And why, if you believe, first of all, do you believe it? And if you do believe it, what do you think it is about the South or the traditions down there that make that so?
Yeah, that's a great question. I do believe that Southerners are great storytellers. I think Appalachians are to an extent. But when I first moved down here to Mississippi a few years ago, one of the things that I had to get adjusted to is the fact that everybody I met and every friendship I made, everyone had a story and everyone loved to tell you the story and everyone loved to tell you the ancillary story that connected to the main story. And so something about a simple question like, oh, well, how's your mom and dad doing? Turns into, you know, a 45-minute story about, oh, they're doing fine, but let me tell you what they did last weekend. And then they tell you that, and that's connected to a story from 3 years ago that might have been something similar or different, which is wonderful. It's great because you get to know people really well. But that was an adjustment for me that Southerners like to talk and they like to tell stories, and it's great. I think it's wonderful. I think the nicest people in the world live in the South. I think the people here, and Appalachians to a large extent too, would give you the shirt off their back if you ask them. I'm fortunate to have a group of friends that I could call at 4 o'clock in the morning and say, hey, I'm stranded on the side of the road, and they wouldn't even blink twice. They'd say, I'll be there in, you know, half an hour to get you, or you just sit tight, I'm on my way. So I think that's a unique kind of character trait that the Southerners have. I think in terms of why is it that way, I think a lot of it has to do with the history of the South, and the fact that the South, you know, historically was not, I don't want to say industrialized. I mean, this goes all the way back to the Civil War and Reconstruction and all of that. But, you know, the South was not industrialized as quickly as the North in terms of transportation infrastructure, in terms of water and sewer and all the kind of the perks that the North had. And so the technological advancements didn't come to the South as quickly as they were in the Northern states. And so, as a result, people pass the time by telling stories, you know, sitting on the porch and, you know, two or three generations of family, you know, sitting by the campfire at night or sitting on the porch on Sunday afternoons, and you didn't really have anything to do or, you know, no roads to get anywhere. And so you sat and told stories, ghost stories and folk tales and all of that. And that just gets passed down from generation to generation. And, you know, now in the South, you know, people tell stories differently. There's, you know, there's social media, obviously, and there's YouTube and TikTok and all these things that you can tell stories. But, you know, at the core of people in the South is this love of telling stories and this love of writing stories and sharing stories. And I think a lot of it just goes back to historic, you know, this historical precedent. But it's wonderful. Yeah, when you come to the South and you meet Southerners, just make sure that you've got plenty of time to talk with them and leave plenty of time for storytelling, because you're not going to have a 10-minute conversation. It's going to go on for a long time.
Or tell them to put it in a book.
Right, exactly.
Just put it in a book and give me the book.
Yeah. Absolutely.
What got you involved in writing novels? I mean, why did you have a desire to be a writer?
You know, this all started back when I was in eighth grade, and I had an eighth grade English teacher. His name was Mr. Cyrus, and he passed away several years ago now. But he saw something in me, a talent in writing that I didn't really see in myself. I'd always liked to write and, you know, doodle and tell little stories. And I had all these little stories written on scrap pieces of paper. But he saw something in me that year. And I can remember he would pull me aside after class, or he'd see me out in the hallway and he'd say, you know, are you writing anything? Are you writing anything? And, you know, any stories or anything, or what are you reading? Or those kinds of things. And I would tell him, and oftentimes he would slip me little pieces of paper that had inspirational quotes about writing. And, I'll just never forget it. And he also taught us how to diagram sentences, which is how I learned how to write. And I wish we taught students at that age how to diagram sentences, because I think our writing would be much better. And once I figured out how to diagram a sentence, I could see how words worked together and against one another to communicate a message and communicate meaning. So I'm thankful to him for that. But long story short, I won the eighth grade writing award that year. I still have the certificate from that. And so that was really, you know, that was really a point where I thought, well, you know, maybe I do have some talent at this. I majored in journalism at Marshall University as an undergrad. And I was a print major, so, you know, working, you know, doing newspapers and press releases and things like that. I joined a creative writing club my senior year because a friend of mine, Zach, was a creative, an English major. And one of the things we did in that club is we sent something. We got together. We met once a week. We got together. We workshopped this piece that we were working on. And we had poets and nonfiction people and memoirists and all of that in that group. And so we made a vow at the end of the year to send out something. And I'd written a little ghost story, and I'd sent it out. This is in the days before submittable and electronic submissions, when you had to get self-addressed stamped envelopes and all of that, in the good old days. And I sent a story out, and a literary journal called Spec at Mary Washington College in Virginia published it. And that was the very first time that I had ever had something creatively of that length published. And that kind of lit a fire under me and kind of gave me a creative spark to keep writing. And I've been writing ever since. And once I had several short stories published and, you know, that seemed to be going well, I wanted to take on the challenge of writing a novel. And as a reader, I find myself gravitating towards novels the most. I mean, I read everything, a lot of everything. But, you know, if you were to, you know, sit me down and say, okay, you can only pick one, you know, one genre to read today or for the next 6 months, I would pick novels. So I had read a lot of them. We talked about Pat Conroy being a big influence on me mm-hmm. from a classical perspective. John Steinbeck is my favorite classical writer. I love John Steinbeck for so many reasons. And so I just thought, you know what, I'm going to challenge myself to do this and see if I can do it. And I thought, well, you know, if I can't do it and it doesn't work out, then, you know, that's fine. But at least I've challenged myself. And I had a professor in college that gave me some good advice when I told him I was going to write a novel. He said, look at it this way. He said, a novel is basically a collection of small scenes of a short story, or it's a collection of smaller short stories within a longer work. And kind of going back to what we were talking about earlier about what makes a good story, you know, you have to have your protagonist want something or need something. And this professor, Derek Nikitas, told me, he said, you know, you just need to look at it this way. Every chapter of a novel needs to either put the protagonist closer to getting what it is that they want or further away from getting what they want. And then the next chapter has to be them sort of working around that rejection. If they didn't get closer, to how are they going to overcome that? Or if they did get a little closer, how are they going to make the next step forward? And so when I was writing a novel, I kept that in the back of my mind. I thought, okay, is my character going to be, is he or she closer at the end of the story, end of this chapter, to getting what they want or getting what they're looking for, what they need, or not? And if so, what am I going to do with them in the next chapter to get them closer or to push them farther away? And so to me, that took a lot of the fear, Mike, and a lot of the trepidation and a lot of the mystery of it away, because I just looked at writing a novel that way, as a series of small short stories within a larger context. I also heard a screenwriter say something similar. And he said, you know, if you're writing a screenplay, you know, each act and each scene in that screenplay is like the scene of a movie, the individual 2 or 3 minute scene of a movie, if you're watching an hour and a half movie. So there's some carryover from that idea into screenwriting as well. But that took away a lot of the mystery for me, and a lot of the fear of writing a novel. And that helped me just realize, okay, this chapter is just a small short story in the larger story arc, or a small scene of a small story in the overall story arc. And that really helped me kind of focus on it and not be so afraid of it.
Yeah. You know, when you got a big project, you break it down into component parts. It just makes sense. So often the novel, even when you're doing that, I mean, it's a major project, but the novel can be intimidating right from the get-go when you think in terms of, wow, you know, I'm going to write 300 pages, maybe 400 pages. And, you know, there's got to be a story arc and this and that. But yeah, breaking it down into those smaller components certainly makes a lot of sense. You know, you're not the typical taciturn writer. You are obviously a very vocal guy, Elliot. And I should tell our listeners that you host a podcast program yourself called Now Appalachia, and where you profile authors and publishers living and writing in the region in Appalachia. And that's carried on what, Blog Talk Radio? Is that the name, or the Air Global Radio Network?
Yeah, Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Yeah, and so the podcast is through that network. Pam Stack owns and operates that network. There's, I think now we're up to 12 or 13 different podcasts on a variety of different themes related to books and writing. And, you know, we have listeners in we're up to 32 or 33 countries all around the world download and listen to not just Now Appalachia, but all the podcasts on the network. So yeah, it's mm-hmm. been a lot of fun, and I've met so many great authors and publishers and agents and publicists and all of that through this process. So it's been a lot of fun, and I really enjoy it.
What was the big break you got? I know you mentioned your instructor back in school, who obviously played a key role. Was there any other turning points along the way where you feel like you made a leap forward? There was a quantum leap or there was a breakthrough. What would you say to that?
Oh yeah, that's a great question, and I know the experience that changed it for me. I had written a story. It was the first book in the Ronan McCullough series, and you mentioned it in the intro. It's called Fragile Brilliance, and basically the premise of that story is Ronan McCullough, who I talked about earlier, is a cop working in Charleston, West Virginia, and he's gay. And that presents a whole series of challenges for him. But he is involved in a relationship with another character named Ty Andino, who is younger than him, but is also the charge nurse at Charleston Mercy Hospital, which is the Trauma One hospital in Charleston. And so one of the dynamics that runs through that series is that when a crime is committed or a suspect is injured in something with the police or is under suspicion, they're taken to the Trauma One hospital there, Charleston Mercy, and Ty is often the charge nurse that's in charge of providing treatment or helping provide treatment along with the doctors there. So Ronan's personal and professional life oftentimes overlaps because he wants to keep Ty sort of safe and out of the business that he's involved in. But at the same time, Ty knows what's going on because oftentimes these people are in the hospital getting treatment for whatever situation. And I wrote that story because that's a story I wanted to tell. You know, Toni Morrison had a great quote one time. Somebody asked her after she won the Pulitzer Prize for Beloved. They said, you know, what advice would you give to someone who's thinking about writing a book? And she said, if there's a story out there that has not been written or is not on a bookshelf, write it. And that was the story I wanted to tell. I wanted to explore these issues and put a cop and his partner in this situation right in the heart of Appalachian. What would that look like? Well, so that book came out in 2016, towards the end of 2016, and Roundfire Press published it. And it was submitted to the Southern it's now called SIBA, the Southern Independent Booksellers Association. But back then it was the Southern Book Prize, and they had different categories. Well, it just so happened the judge that year was Pat Conroy. And that was the last year he judged the contest before he got sick. He died, as you mentioned, of pancreatic cancer a few years ago. But this was the last year that he did it because he was ill. And his health was failing, and so he judged the thriller category for the Southern Book Prize that year, and I was a finalist, and I got picked by Pat Conroy as a finalist, and I don't know how many people had submitted, but I was on a finalist list with John Grisham, I was on a finalist list with Greg Iles, I was on a finalist list with I believe Catherine Coulter was on that list that year. For one of the books in her Kay Scarpetta mystery series, which is great. Uh-huh. And then me, and there was one other person. I don't remember who the other person was. And I thought,
so you're saying John Grisham was one of the guys who was picked. He was part of the group that got selected along with you.
Right. Yeah. So Pat selected five writers. I believe it was Catherine Coulter. I'd have to look and see, but I know Grisham and Greg Iles were on there on that list. And I thought, there's no way. I thought, this is stupid. I have no business being on any list with John Grisham and Greg Iles, nor do I have any business in Pat Conroy picking me and picking my story for something that to be recognized for an award. And unfortunately, there was supposed to be an award ceremony, and we were going to get to meet him. And I think his health wasn't good, and that got canceled. So I never got to meet Pat Conroy or John Grisham or Greg Iles or any of those people. But that was a turning point for me, Mike, because I thought, you know, I mean, here, I just wanted to tell this story, you know, and I thought, when, you know, nobody's going to care about this story. It's set in West Virginia. Who's going to care about, you know, this cop and his partner and kind of their trials, both personally and professionally. And to have Pat Conroy pick that and say, this was one of the five best stories I read all that year. That had been submitted for the award was just a true honor. And it's something I'll never forget. I feel like if I never write another story, if I never have another word published, I can say that I was on that list. Now, I'll tell you a little funny anecdote, footnote to that story. I was teaching at Mount West Community College in West Virginia at the time that happened. And I got this very nice packet from Greg Iles' publicist, congratulating me for being on the finalist list with him. And he sent me a copy of Greg Iles' book. And I don't remember which book it was that, of his that was a finalist, but it said, "We just wanted to send you a copy of this in case you would like to use this in your English classes next year." And so mm-hmm. I just felt that was kind of funny. It's like, congratulations. We're so honored that you were on a list with him, but now here, you know, would you like to adopt his book for your literature class next year? So, you know, the publicity and book selling never stops, I guess. So that was a kind of funny footnote about that. But, anyway, so that was that's been the highlight of my writing life. I mean, to have a writer who I just put on the pantheon of writing say that my story was good enough to be compared with those other two or other three writers is just remarkable. And
it's that's high honor.
Something I'll never
absolutely
forget.
You know, you talk about, you do workshops, and one of the things that you talk about is developing your author platform. And you do a variety of different workshops, and you'll even tailor them to what a group or individual is looking for. Talk about your author platform. What are the components, or what are the what does your platform consist of?
Oh, sure. You know, I think you have to have several components to the platform. I think you need to have a social media presence. I was a gung-ho social media user when it first came out, but I'm kind of waning with it a little bit, as it's kind of evolved.
Why is that?
Changed. Well, I think, you know, there's a lot of, it's a time waster for one thing. I'm amazed when I'm on Facebook or Twitter, how, you know, 20 minutes goes by and all I've done is scroll through, you know, two or three lists of posts. I mean, I enjoy it because you get to keep up with friends and family, and you know, I'm of the age now where I have friends that are having kids and grandchildren and all of that. So it's fun to see all of that and Easter pictures and Christmas photos and all of that. But there's a lot of nonsense and garbage on social media too, misinformation.
Yes.
And just crap that's out there, for lack of a better term. So I'm not as gung-ho with it as I used to be, but if you're an author, you need to be there. You need to have a Facebook profile. You need to have an Instagram account. You need to have a Twitter account. You need to be active. It doesn't necessarily always mean you have to promote yourself or promote your books, but you need to have a presence there. You need to have a website. You need to have a website that's as current and up to date as you can, and hire someone that professionally knows how to do those. Otherwise, it's going to look like, you know, someone in your middle school, one of your middle school neighbor's friends, you know, put it together, and it's just not going to look professional. So, you know, get that. I think you have to have that social media platform. I think you have to be willing to, you also, as a writer on the technical side, you need to be in a writing group. You need to have a critique group out of that writing group, if that was what you're writing, you know, people that you can share your work with and get feedback from. And this isn't your wife or your son or your daughter or your mother or father, that, you know, because they're going to tell you everything that you write's wonderful. These are people that can give you, you know, objective, honest feedback about things that are working and not working. If you're not in a writing group, you can start one yourself if there's not one in your community or neighborhood. You need to, I recommend for folks to attend at least one writing conference every year, like one national writing conference every year, if you can afford it. There's a ton of those for mystery and thriller writers. There's the Left Coast Crime Conference, which happens in March every year. There's the Killer Nashville, Mystery Writers Conference, which is in August. There is International Thriller Writers, which is in July every year in New York. There's just a variety of different, the Mystery Writers of Mystery Writers of America does a conference every year in Las Vegas. If you're not a mystery thriller writer, find a national conference that's tied to the genre you're writing in and go. And go to those workshops, network with other writers, network with publishers and publicists, you know, find out what's going on, find ways to make your toolkit stronger as a writer. I think that's a huge component of your platform. I think that, you know, offer to do workshops, you know, offer to share your expertise. If you're a published writer, if you've had any published credit to your name, go to your public library, offer to do a workshop. Find out if there's a writer's organization in your state or your community. Join that organization, volunteer to do workshops and share your knowledge with others and get your name out there. Look for opportunities where you can promote yourself and sell books if you have published works to your credit. That doesn't always mean bookstores, Mike. That oftentimes means fairs and festivals. That oftentimes means gift shops in your community or in your region. That means state park gift shops. Places where you can be kind of the the author, the only author that has their works available for sale. I'll give you a quick example of what I'm talking about. When I lived in West Virginia, another author friend of mine, Casey Bond, and I, we rented a booth at something called the Pumpkin Festival, which is a big arts and crafts event that takes place every year in October. Well, Casey and I rented a booth, and we were the only authors there selling books. And this event has, you know, between 15 and 20,000 people that come from all over West Virginia, Ohio, and Kentucky, and all over Appalachia to come to this event. Well, I sold 7 or 8 cases of books that weekend, and so did Casey, mainly because we were the only people there selling books. There were 4 or 5 people selling yard signs, and 4 or 5 people were selling fudge, and 4 or 5 people were selling scarves, but we were the only people that were selling books. And even if we didn't sell books directly, we were connecting with readers, and we were able to pass out information about our work. And we were, you know, I met all kinds of teachers, college professors, librarians that were at that event. And I was able to give them cards and say, yeah, I'd love to come and talk to your class. I'd love to come do a workshop at the library. I'd love to come and do something at your school. And so that helps build your platform, get your name out there. And that wasn't a bookstore. I could have sat at our local Books a Million for probably that length of time over 6 months and maybe had not made those kinds of connections. So, you know, looking for ways to showcase your work that's outside of a bookstore is another way to build your author platform. And I guess the last thing I would say on it is anytime an opportunity is presented to you as a writer, say yes. Don't say no, even if it's requiring you to step outside of your comfort zone. And as you mentioned a minute ago, Mike, you know, we spend a lot of time by ourselves as writers, and we typically are introverts in a lot of ways. And so sort of being out there and kind of selling ourselves and promoting ourselves is not really second nature to us. But if you have opportunities, say yes. I mean, when Pam Stack approached me, for example, to host a podcast program, I knew nothing about podcasts other than how to listen to them. I had no idea how to record one, how to do one. Could I host one? Would anybody listen? Would anybody want to come on the show? And it's been a tremendous help in establishing and building and growing my platform. So I would say any opportunity that you're given like that, say yes and try it and do it, because you can always change your mind later and say, well, this wasn't for me. But that has been the biggest help to me in building my platform, is when opportunities like that have come, just say yes, give it a try, and you'll be amazed at how much better it will go than you think it will. And so those are some of the key components, and I wish we had more time. I could, you know, talk, you know, I could do 75-minute workshop on building.
Well, yeah, but somebody can hire you to do a workshop
and explain everything
in detail. But I mean, obviously there's a lot of moving pieces there. There's a lot of attention that needs to be paid. This is the kind of thing that so many writers just don't want to do. They shy away from because it's just, look, I want to do the work and I want people to read it. And that's such a big distraction. But the ones who really are successful, this is what they do. They have to really get their name out there. That's really what it takes. Now, I noticed that you've got something called the extroverted introverted writer. Now, this goes hand in hand with the whole author platform thing, then, that you've got to be able to play the role of an extrovert at times so that you can get out there and do the things that you were talking about? Or is that something completely separate from the author platform?
It's connected in some ways in terms of, I guess the main thread that connects those two would be that, you know, there are moments where you're going to have to be, you know, sort of the extrovert and introvert, and you're going to kind of have to put yourself out there, and you're going to have to do that, because, you know, you may have a great publisher, you may have a great marketing team or marketing plan behind your book. You may have, a great publicist you're working with, either one from the publisher or one that you've hired yourself. But ultimately, the expert on your book is you. And when people want to hear about your book and about why you wrote it, what it's about, what genre is it, why did you write it, all of those things, they want to hear it from the writer themselves. That they may pay attention to it if it comes from a YouTube commercial or a book trailer, or, you know, someone speaking on your behalf saying, oh yeah, I read this book, it was really great, whatever endorsement you may have. But ultimately, they want to hear it from you, and you are the expert. You know your book better than anybody else, even the publisher and the editor and all those people that put it together for you. You are the one that is the expert on that story and on that book. And so being able to sort of step out of that role of being the introvert And I love people. I love, you know, doing workshops and everything. But I am that extroverted introvert because after I do those things, it takes me a day or two to recover. You know, I need a day or two to just kind of not talk to anybody, decompress, and not really kind of do that. I've been that way my whole life. But you have to be willing to do that, I think.
Well, and, you know, it's nice to be able to say when you've got a book on the shelf that this is a writer who I met. This is his novel or her novel. I met the person. I like to buy art from, and I'm not an art collector or anything, and I don't buy expensive art. But when if I've met the artist and they've told me what the piece is about, now all of a sudden I've got this interest in, I've got a connection to it, and to be able to buy something from somebody who created it, you've met them, they told you what was behind it, what inspired it. That is as meaningful. And it would be the same for a novel. I think in a lot of cases, it's having met a writer, a novelist, buying the novel is now there's a story associated with the novel. There's an explanation of it. There's the having met the author. There's a story to pass along to other people when you talk about that novel or somebody sees it sitting on the coffee table or what have you. You know, there are so many great quotations from writers and about writing. Do you have a favorite? Is there a quotation that you put at the bottom of your email messages or that you always say at the start of the semester at the university or maybe one that is sitting on a plaque on your desk that you like to look at and read just before you get going with the writing?
Yes. One of my favorite writing quotes comes from Ray Bradbury, who is a science fiction writer. Many of us probably have read some of his work in elementary school or in middle school. His short stories oftentimes are anthologized in those high school and middle school literature textbooks. But he has one of my great quotes. He has a great quote on writing and one of my favorite quotes on writing. And it's basically, with writing, you jump off the cliff and find your wings on the way down.
Yeah, it sounds a little death-defying, but I got to tell you, I love Ray Bradbury quotes. He's got a lot of them, and I don't know if you've ever seen him live. Have you ever seen him speak live?
No, I have not. I have not seen him speak live. I've watched him speak, you know, on YouTube clips and PBS documentaries and things like that, but never heard him speak live.
Well, actually, the YouTube clips probably would suffice because he is the most enthusiastic writer I think I've ever heard in my life. I mean, you can't wait to start writing when you walk out of one of his keynote addresses. This was at some business event, in fact. It wasn't even at a writer's conference or what have you, but he was incredible. And this is when, I mean, only a handful of years before he died, he was still loaded with enthusiasm and just still very much in love with writing and very energetic guy. And, you know, anybody who needed a jumpstart, Ray Bradbury, going to see him speak would have been a great thing. Unfortunately, yeah, he is now departed, but his work stays behind. His lifetime of work is still there. So what do you have working right now? Do you have a book in the works, Elliot?
I do. I'm working on another collection of short stories called Table for Two. And I'm about five or six stories into that collection. Basically, the theme of that book is all of the short stories involve conflict between just two characters. And so there may be, you know, some smaller characters that kind of come into a scene and leave briefly, but the central conflict in each one of those stories involves two people, either a husband and wife, a father and son, son and daughter, neighbor and neighbor, a variety of different circumstances there. And Table for Two will be kind of the center piece story for that. So I'm working on that, and I'm also almost finished with the next draft of my book in the next book in the Ronan McCullough series. It's called Double Crossed, and it picks up a few months after everything wraps up in A Knife's Edge, which is the second book in the Ronan McCullough series. So I've got about 3,000, 3,500 more words to go for that book. And I hope to have that finished here by late spring of 2022. And I hope to have the short story collection put together by fall of 2022. So yeah, I've got two kind of different projects working right now, but hope to have
been doing a lot of writing. You've been doing a lot of writing.
Yes.
Talk about your regimen. How often do you write? When do you write? How much productivity do you get per session?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. I used to be a writer because of my teaching schedule when I lived in West Virginia. I used to have to get up really, really early in the morning and write, you know, some awful hour like 5 or 5:30, something around that time to get the writing in because my teaching schedule was different and I had other commitments and obligations. And so I would get up and start writing, you know, in the morning before everybody in the house got up and before the animals got up and wanted food and all of that and everything. Now that I work at Ole Miss and my teaching schedule is different and my responsibilities are different, I found myself writing, you know, late morning, early afternoon now, which is usually a bit better for me. I'm kind of a late morning, early afternoon person. Like I do my best work, I think, between like 9 and 1:30 every day. After about 1:30, my brain starts to slowly shut down as the afternoon goes on. But I try to write about 5 days a week. I do not put myself on a word count or a page quota. I know some writers do that, but I give myself at least 90 minutes to write during those periods. I feel like that 90 minutes gives you a chance to make some progress on your work and also gives you a chance to kind of get your mind back in the space where you were in your story or in the book when you previously left off. And I just feel like for me, less than 90 minutes oftentimes just doesn't give me enough time. So I try to write for at least 90 minutes mm-hmm. a day, 5 days a week. And I try to write in that peak time where my mind is fresh, usually between 9:30 and like 9 and 1:30-ish every day. And some days I get, you know, 50 words on the page. Some days I'll really get into it and I'll have, you know, 500 words by the time the 90 minutes is up. But, there is no substitution, Mike, for what they call seat time or butt in the chair time. You know, if you want to write and you want to create stories and you want to be a writer, you know, the only way that it's going to get done is by, you know, your butt in the chair, or your seat in the chair time. And so for me, I think 90 minutes works well. Sometimes I will go past 90 minutes if I'm really in a groove. I've found for me personally, after about 2.5 hours, my brain is tired and I need to kind of take a break and step away from it for a while. Sometimes that means I'll come back later in the day and finish, or I won't pick it up again until tomorrow. But, that's how I do it. I just carve out time in my schedule every day, at least 5 days a week to do it. If I wait for the inspiration to strike, or if I wait for the writer's muse to get interested, I'll never get anything done because there's always papers to grade, dishes to do, laundry to do, grass to cut. There's always other things pulling at your time.
Plenty of distractions. Yeah, yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
So you're a genre writer. I think you would consider yourself a genre writer. You do thrillers, and there are genre writers, John Grisham being one of them, who wanted to do something outside of genre. And he wrote something, at least one book he wrote that was kind of like, well, this is the stuff maybe that he would like to be writing, but he knew that that his legal thrillers are what really made the money. And obviously he loves doing it because or he never would have got started with it. But then a lot of times people want to step outside of their genre. John D. McDonald did that as well. My favorite book he ever wrote was not one of his genre runs. I referred to this recently on a podcast, but A Key to the Suite is just outstanding. And I wish he had written more like that rather than so many Travis McGee novels. But do you have any pull in that direction, or does your short story collections, are those also thriller short stories, or is that your way of getting outside of the space just a little bit, like kind of getting your yayas out?
Yeah, some of my short stories are thriller stories. My first collection of stories, which came out at probably the worst time ever, which was right when the pandemic started in May of 2020, was called Snapshots. And I had two or three thriller stories in that collection. There were, I believe, 11 stories in that collection. But I was able to step outside of some of those. And I had a speculative fiction story or speculative fiction themed story in the collection. I had a romance story in that collection. I had a family drama story in that collection. I had a story around social justice and crime and law and order sort of themes in that collection. And so there was a lot of tension. There was a lot of characters being put in difficult situations where they had to maybe do some things and say some things and make some decisions that conflicted with their personal beliefs or feelings. So the tension was there and the suspense was there, but it gave me a chance to kind of step outside of the traditional thriller parameters and flex my muscles a little bit. And I wanted to do that mainly because I feel like as a writer, I learned how to write from writing short stories. And I love short stories as a reader. I'm so glad that short story collections are making a comeback now. You know, five, 10 years ago, an author couldn't sell a short story collection to really any press, small press, university press, big publisher. And now I think maybe this has more to do with the way we read and consume information now and our short attention spans, but short stories are making a comeback. So I'm glad to see that. Mm-hmm. But I feel like that's where I learned to cut my teeth as a writer, writing those short stories. And so for me, getting back into that mode of writing short stories is so much fun. And getting to kind of step outside of the traditional thriller rules and tropes that oftentimes come with that challenges me as a writer in a lot of ways, but also kind of gets me connected back to my roots where it all started for me, which was writing short stories.
Our guest has been Elliot Parker. You can learn more about him at elliotparker.com. That link is in the episode notes. Elliot, thank you for taking the time and coming on the program and sharing your insights with us.
Thanks, Mike. I appreciate you having me on. I'm a big fan of your show, and I appreciate what you do to support writers. So thanks so much.